Member Week is here at Lowe's. That means it's time for MyLowe's Rewards members to save big with up to 40% off hundreds of items like appliances, tools, home essentials, and more. Plus, get free standard shipping. Shop these exclusive member-only savings now through October 15th. Not a rewards member? Join for free today. Free standard shipping not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Thanks for joining us. I am delighted to welcome budget guru Jessica Riedel today to talk about the ins and outs of the budget, federal spending, DOGE, and related matters. So thanks for so much for being here, Jessica. All right. So we have the image now of Elon Musk with his, you know, chainsaw going through the federal budget in a very discriminating and careful fashion. One of the things I hope you can clarify for listeners is, because there are a lot of us who've always been interested in, you know, fiscal responsibility, taking budget deficits seriously, but let's talk about discretionary spending. Back in the old days, before you were born, probably, Ross Perot, who was like a big budget cutter of his day, although a little bit crazy. But anyway, he used to have these pie charts that he would bring on TV to show people how much we were spending and where. And I wonder if we could tap into that just a little bit, because what DOGE is doing is just going after discretionary spending. So if you could sketch out a little bit, like, how do we spend our money, our federal money? What percentage is actually discretionary spending?
Sure. And I will date myself by saying I was in high school when Ross Perot was running for president in 1992, but I appreciate the compliment of being born yet. So if you just step back first and look at the entire federal budget, 75% of all federal spending goes to six items: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, veterans, and interest. That's three quarters of the budget. Discretionary spending is the part with defense and veterans in there. Discretionary spending is about 30% of the budget. It's the portion of federal spending that actually goes through the budget process and is not on autopilot automatically, like, say, Social Security is. So it's about 30% of the budget. More than half of discretionary spending goes to defense, veterans, and border security, which conservatives generally support. You also have things like foreign aid, health research, education, housing, a lot of government administration, some of the
FAA.
FAA, highway spending, transportation, Coast Guard. Really, everything that's not big benefits to individuals is discretionary spending.
Yeah. And so that spending can be changed year to year, but it is never cut, right? I mean, sometimes we reduce the rate of increase and call it a cut, but can you recall a time where there's ever been an actual cut in expenditures?
Possibly around the 94-95 Newt Gingrich era, it may have dropped 1 or 2% in 1 year.
Okay.
But, you know, even during the heyday of the Budget Control Act, the BCA caps that Obama and Boehner negotiated in 2011.
BCA, what was that? What was that? Sorry.
This was out of the grand deal budget negotiations that President Obama and John Boehner had in 2011. They ended up passing the Budget Control Act, which supposedly was going to cut about $1.7 trillion over 10 years from the growth of discretionary spending. So they weren't reducing levels by $1.7 trillion. They were just reducing the growth rate. Ultimately, even only half of that ended up taking place. The BCA was immediately ripped up before the ink was even dry. But even then, it only slowed the growth of discretionary spending. This stuff almost never gets reduced in nominal dollars.
So let's talk about, so you said Medicaid is in the bucket of entitlement spending that is not discretionary?
Correct.
So, okay, so then what's all this talk that we're hearing about the Republican Congress, you know, talking about making $880 billion proposed cuts. What's going on there?
The House Republican budget, in order to pay for $4.5 trillion in tax cuts over the decade, assumes $1.2 trillion in cuts to entitlement spending, to mandatory spending over 10 years. Of that, $880 billion would go from Medicaid, likely. About $300 billion would come from likely student loans, and about $200 billion or $250 billion would come from food assistance programs. Now, you'll notice that adds up to more than $1.2 trillion in cuts because they would also increase defense and border spending by $300 billion and count that as mandatory spending now, as entitlement spending, in order to put it into that bucket. Okay. Even if they do these cuts, you're still only reducing $1.2 trillion over 10 years in order to offset $4.5 trillion in tax cuts.
So, yeah, let's pull the lens back for a second and get your views. I mean, what do you make of the Trump plan to cut taxes again? In light of where we are now compared with where we were in 2017. I don't know what your view was in 2017. Were you pro or con the tax cut then? I don't remember.
In 2017, I liked the policies in many ways. I wanted them to be paid for.
Yeah, okay. And they weren't. So how much did they increase the deficit by in the first Trump term before COVID?
Well, the cost of that tax cut was about $1.5 trillion over 10 years, so about $150 billion per year. When Trump took office in 2017, he inherited a budget deficit of $585 billion. This time around,
seems like
he's
nothing.
Inheriting a budget deficit of $1.8 trillion, three times bigger.
Yeah. Okay. So what's your view about the proposed tax cut? And also that no tax on tips and no tax on overtime and no tax on Social Security benefits and whatever.
I think we can't afford it. I say this, I believe some of the tax cuts should be extended, but they need to be offset elsewhere. We already face baseline deficits of about $22 trillion over the next decade.
What's a baseline deficit?
The baseline deficit is the deficit if we just continue current law. If you just extend out all current laws already on the books, you know, keep Social Security running, keep defense running, keep the tax code running, you have about $22 trillion in borrowing over 10 years. The tax cuts would add $4.5 trillion. So now you're looking at about $26.5 trillion in borrowing over the decade. To put it in terms of the annual deficit, if we extend out all current taxes and spending, the budget deficit in a decade goes to about $3.6 trillion a year. And that's under low interest rates. If interest rates rise, the interest on the debt gets more expensive. We could be looking at annual budget deficits of $4 trillion a year within the next decade. So if Congress wants to extend the tax cuts, and again, I'm not saying they should all be gotten rid of, look for some ways to pay for it. And I do not think that eliminating taxes on tips and overtime and Social Security benefits are particularly affordable either. Republicans always say, we can afford big tax cuts as long as we, you know, cut spending. Now is your chance. They need to cut the spending.
Uh, d- don't see much evidence that they're going to cut it in a serious way or in a responsible way. So talk a little bit about the interest rate problem here, because you mentioned in a piece that you did for the Dispatch that the bond markets sort of have a vote here, right? Can you explain that to listeners? What does that mean? You know, that like I remember first hearing about this when Bill Clinton was president, and he came into office and he had all these plans. He was going to do a big healthcare bill. He was going to do a variety of different things. And then his Treasury Secretary, Rubin, I think his name was, anyway, said, well, you know, you have to pay attention to how the bond market is reacting. And Clinton, at least this so it was reported at the time, said, you mean we're held captive by the bond markets? So can you explain that?
You know, back then, a story from back then, as James Carville said during an Oval Office meeting, that when he dies, he wants to come back as the bond market so that he can scare everybody. He wants to be reincarnated for Halloween as the bond market. Yeah. The bond market is simply the reality that for the government to borrow all of these trillions of dollars, somebody has to lend the government the money. And if the government is borrowing more money than the bond market can easily lend us, that's going to push up interest rates. And by pushing up interest rates, you A, hurt the private economy because it's going to be more expensive to buy a home, buy a car, student loans, because all the money you want to borrow is instead being borrowed by Uncle Sam. It also costs Washington money because as the interest rate goes up, they have to borrow even more. So to put some numbers on it, we've already had interest on the debt go from $350 billion in 2021 to $880 billion now. And it's going to be more than a trillion this year. To put this in context,
just say that one more time, because this is a podcast and I want people to be able to digest it. So just repeat.
Absolutely.
That.
Interest on the debt was $350 billion in 2021. It's
right.
$880 billion now. And it's heading to $2 trillion a year in the next decade.
It's
now,
insane.
To put these numbers in context, in 2023, interest surpassed Medicaid in the federal budget. Last year, it surpassed defense. This year, interest will also surpass Medicare. That means after this year, interest will be the second biggest part of the budget after Social Security, and it's going to pass Social Security in 2042. And that's the rosy scenario. This is the scenario that the Congressional Budget Office created that assumes that interest rates stay at 3.5% ultimately forever. Well, the interest rates right now Washington's borrowing at are about 4.5% and going higher. If interest rates rise, you could be looking again at interest costing as much as $2.5 trillion a year, or a third of all your taxes a decade from now. That's why we pay attention to the bond market, because if we borrow more than they can easily lend us, you know the law of demand, the price or the interest rate will rise.
Will have to go up, right. So what is your sense of the, you know, Elon Musk with his chainsaw and the cuts that we're seeing to all of these discretionary programs? As a budget hawk, what do you make of that as policymaking?
I consider DOGE to be spending cut theater. I do not consider it a serious effort for multiple reasons. First off, they can't legally reduce spending levels. All DOGE can do is reprogram spending, because spending levels are set by Congress. And if you save money in one area, they're required to spend the money in another area unless Congress passes a bill taking back the spending authority. But more specifically than that, what Musk has gone after aren't the big drivers of spending. He's not looking in discretionary spending at defense contracts or overpayments or waste fraud or real waste fraud and abuse. He's going after DEI contracts, political subscriptions, federal employees. the kind of things that really excite the MAGA base, but are not even a rounding error in terms of the deficit. They put out a website about a week and a half ago, Doge did, claiming $55 billion in savings. But if you actually went through the website and the examples, there were so many mathematical and accounting errors that the real savings were closer to $2 billion. $2 billion is
compared to 55.
Yeah, and it's
they claimed 55, and you're saying it's actually two.
And it's 1/35 of 1% of federal spending.
Yeah, so it really it is theater, but it is also it's so damaging. First of all, it discredits the whole idea of careful budgeting and being, you know, judicious about how we spend money. I mean, it would be so great if some administration someday said, you know what, we're going to audit these programs. We're going to see where we might have duplicative programs. We're going to be, you know, intelligent about trying to, you know, pare back things that are unnecessary or wasteful. But oh my God, I mean, they have no idea what they're doing. A bunch of pimply faced, you know, grad students are going through and just slashing things, and they have no understanding even of what they're doing. So that, and they seem to think that they can just like, oh, well, if we do fire the people who keep our nuclear weapons safe or who, you know, do international monitoring of new pathogens or, you know, various other things, well, we'll just hire them back. And yeah, your comments.
Yeah, I mean, if they wanted to go after real waste, OMB, the President's Budget Office, last year identified $191 billion lost to payment errors in major programs, like overpayments, untracked payments, unqualified payments. The GAO, government's accounting auditors, estimates as much as $400 billion in what can be truly specified and identified as waste, fraud, and abuse in the truest accounting sense. If Musk was going after that, you could find real savings and do it in ways Congress would embrace. But instead, we're getting this ideological project, and the examples are painful. You saw that when they put out their $55 billion list, they had an $8 billion cut, the biggest one possible, that was actually $8 million. They missed, the Doge people entered the wrong number. You have false claims that we've sent 1.5 billion condoms to Gaza. You have, you mentioned, accidentally firing and rehiring top secret nuclear weapons workers, as well as bird flu trackers. They have fired federal employees for incompetence because they were listed as probationary.
Yeah.
Doge thought probationary meant low performing rather than less than a year in their current job. Another great example, they deleted the word equity from the IRS tax handbooks because they thought it was a DEI reference rather than a tax term for equal treatment across different populations. So this is
Maybe they thought it was maybe it was the word for a stock. Maybe they're going to think every stock in the world, every equity is part of DEI.
It's unbelievable. It is such an amateur hour. And what this is doing is discrediting the entire practice of deficit reduction. I have written 600 articles and reports over 23 years on how to reduce spending and deficits. And the point is, it's hard and it takes everyone rolling up their sleeves. And what Doge is telling everybody is we can balance the budget by just cutting DEI and political pro and firing some government employees, and none of you have to sacrifice any program that matters to you. It's not true.
Yeah, we thought the big lie was the stolen election of 2020, and that was. But the big lies are, it's a rolling phenomenon. I mean, they're just one after another after another. Are you ready to optimize your nutrition this year? Factor has chef-made gourmet meals that make eating well easy. They're dietitian approved and ready to heat and eat in 2 minutes so you can fuel right and feel great, no matter what life throws at you. Factor arrives fresh and fully prepared, perfect for any active, busy lifestyle. If you're thinking about a weight loss program, you can lose up to 8 pounds in 8 weeks with the Factor Keto meals. This was based on a randomized controlled clinical trial with Factor Keto. Results can vary depending on diet and exercise. With 40 options across 8 dietary preferences on the menu each week, it's easy to pick meals tailored to your goals. Choose from preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, or Keto. Factor can help you feel your best all day long with wholesome smoothies, breakfasts, grab-and-go snacks, and more add-ons. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. In my house, I have to be fast because my husband loves to grab the Factor meals before he heads off to the office. Because they're fresh, they're not frozen, he just pops them in his bag and at lunchtime in the microwave for 2 minutes, and he has a fresh, delicious lunch. Doesn't have to go to a restaurant, spend a lot of money, doesn't have to defrost anything. It's very, very convenient, not to mention delicious. Eat smart with Factor. Get started at factormeals.com/factorpodcast and use code FACTORPODCAST to get 50% off your first box plus free shipping. That's FACTORPODCAST at factormeals.com/factorpodcast to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. So let's talk a little bit about Trump's whole vision of the economy, because, you know, he imagines that he is going to make America great again, or, you know, make the economy thrive by all of these tax cuts, which we've already talked about, which are unsustainable. And he's talked about tariffs. We don't know. I mean, so he threatened them on Canada-Mexico, then withdrew it. Now he's threatening them again. Actually, before we get to the tariffs, let me just ask you about that in particular. What do you think the effect on the U.S. economy is going to be, or maybe already is, of all of this uncertainty, where we have rule by the mad king? And so nobody knows, like, from day to day how things are going to change, really important things like tariffs. What do you think that does to the economy?
We're already seeing it. Consumer confidence has been falling since Trump took office. Consumer spending has started falling already. We're going to see business investments start falling as well, because the one thing businesses can't handle when they're making long-term investment decisions is economic uncertainty. They don't know how to price that into their models. The fact that consumers are already pulling back and consumer confidence is already falling just from the threat of broader-based tariffs than just the small China ones we've done so far, suggests that the laws of economics have not been repealed. Trump can say whatever he wants about tariffs, that China will pay them, it's going to be the greatest economy ever, but the laws of economics still apply, and I am worried that the early economic indicators are pretty negative.
Yeah. The Atlanta Fed is now predicting negative growth in the first quarter. Did you see that?
I have not seen that. It does not surprise me.
So, and a recession is defined as two quarters of negative growth in a row. So, we will see. But I'd be interested to hear you explain about our aging population and the issue of both deportation and immigration, because in order to have economic growth, you wrote, you have to have either huge growth in worker productivity or huge growth or growth in the workforce or both. But what are we looking at under the Trump dispensation?
Yeah, economic growth is really just the growth of the labor force, the number of workers and how much they're working, times the growth of productivity, how much each worker produces per hour. Productivity times labor force growth equals economic growth. And in the past, say from 1950 to 1980, the reason the economy grew by an average of 3.9% was because we had a lot of labor force growth. We had more women entering the workforce, followed by baby boomers entering the workforce. The problem we're having now is the labor force has dropped to about 0.4% growth due to retiring baby boomers, low fertility, and restricted immigration. And under Trump's deportation plans and immigration plans, for whatever their merits they may have in other areas, they could actually push population growth negative over the next decade. If you have negative population growth, then all economic growth can only come from productivity. Productivity has been growing at about 1.6% this century. So you're looking at, instead of having growth jump, as Trump always promises, to 2, 3, 4%, you would need to maintain current productivity just to do 1.6%. If you want to hit the 3% target, you would have to double productivity. So it's really, really hard to grow the economy briskly with a shrinking or stagnant labor force. And that's what Trump is proposing.
Let me ask you another economic conundrum that one hears, and I'm not sure that I understand it completely, so I'm hoping you can explain it. So we've been hearing warnings for decades about our yearly deficits and our accumulating debt, and there have been warnings that, you know, international markets may at some point say, we won't loan you money anymore. But then there is this phenomenon where the United States is the world, the dollar is the world's reserve currency, and that this is a superpower because whether it's in Caracas or, you know, Beijing or wherever, people always want to have dollars. And as long as that's true, as long as dollars are perceived to be the best store of value in the world, we get a free pass in terms of being irresponsible about our budget deficits. So can you explain how these two things interact and what we should make of that?
I think there's some truth to it, but I think some have vastly overstated how much we can rely on international borrowing. Right now, the debt held by the public is about $30 trillion. Foreigners hold about $3 or $4 trillion, and that number has been reducing. China only holds $1 trillion, Japan only holds about $1 trillion, and they're pulling back, and they don't really have a big enough economy to push that up too high. However, over the next 30 years, just under current policies, the debt's going to go from $30 trillion to $200 trillion. Let me repeat that, from $30 trillion to $200 trillion. Even if China and Japan quadrupled their debt holdings, even if the rest of the world quadrupled their debt holdings, you're still at about 12 to 15 trillion out of 200 trillion. And the problem is the global economy is just not big enough to handle a debt as big as America's. You know, when Greece goes under, the rest of the world can easily afford to bail out Greece. When America goes under, other countries' economies just aren't big enough. So we do have a certain home field advantage with the dollar. There will always be a bias towards holding dollars as long as we're the reserve currency. But when you're talking about a debt going from $30 trillion to $200 trillion, China, Japan, everyone else, they can't hold anything close to that.
Do you think the status of the dollar as the reserve currency is also is endangered at all by erratic behavior by the United States vis-a-vis our allies, vis-a-vis our enemies, the fact that we're cozying up to Russia, the fact that we are imposing tariffs, maybe not imposing tariffs. Does all of that affect whether people want to hold dollars or no?
In the short term, the dollar is still going to be king because there aren't a lot of alternatives for the rest of the world to rally around. Over the long term, if the United States economy continues to slip, as it looks like it may, as budget deficits rise, population falls, and as our government becomes more erratic, it would not be too surprising for another currency to emerge as the reserve currency, whether it's China or Euro or something else. It could happen at some point. That being said, you know, even the concept of a reserve currency might start to fade away in the next couple decades because we live in a world where you can wake up in the morning, sell from the British stock market, move your money to the German market in the morning, then to the US and another country by evening. When money can move around that fast with a click, even the concept of a reserve currency might gradually start to move out. But as long as they are holding physical cash, it's going to be dollars in the short term, not necessarily the long term.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the kinds of things we hear from Bernie Sanders and people like him. Sanders has a way of always suggesting that all of our budgetary problems would be solved if we would simply tax millionaires and billionaires more. Now, speaking for myself, I'm not against raising taxes on the super rich, but as I understand it, there isn't enough money there to really do the job. What do you say to that?
Let's have some fun with the numbers.
Okay.
There's 800 billionaire families in America. If we seized every penny of wealth that they own, every stock market investment, yacht, home, car, their kids' toys, and sold them, you could fund the government one time for 8 months, and then it's gone forever. Or let's say we assessed a 100% tax rate on all income over $500,000. Anything you earn over $500,000 goes to the government. And let's assume they keep working at those rates. You still don't come close to balancing the budget. The reality is there aren't enough rich people to balance or to make a significant dent in a deficit this big. Now, I'm okay with raising taxes on the rich as part of a grand solution, but you just can't raise it enough to make much of a difference. I did a report 2 years ago where I said, let's figure out what's the most we can get realistically from taxing the rich. I built a model setting every tax rate and every tax policy for the rich at the revenue maximizing rate. I got about 1% of GDP in higher revenues from that. And that's out of a budget deficit that's 6% of GDP today and going to 14% of GDP in 30 years. So sure, if you really want to, you can get some more money from the rich, and we probably should. But you're not going to fix the budget. And Europe doesn't fix the budget by their budget by taxing the rich. And even in the heyday of the 1950s, we didn't raise that much more from those 91% tax rates. You got to tax everybody.
Well, that is what Europe does, right? I mean, they have much higher rates of taxation on the middle class than we do.
Europe raises, on average, 7.5% of GDP in revenues higher than us. How do they get 7.5% of GDP more? Because every EU country except America has a value-added tax, which is essentially a national sales tax, and they raise an average of 7.2% of GDP. You take out VATs, and the US matches Europe. In fact, our tax rates on the rich are higher than the EU average. The difference is they hit the middle class with essentially national sales taxes, and we don't.
Yeah. Okay. So we can't get there by taxing the rich. But we're not going to get there through this kind of insane, completely unrealistic, Doge-inflected Trumpism either. And so in this world, I mean, I feel like this is almost a fanciful question for you. But if we were to return to a common sense approach about dealing with this. I mean, we are very, very amazingly wealthy country that does provide tremendous opportunities for people from around the globe and for ourselves. And we, you know, hopefully are not in the midst of destroying all of that. So if we ever do get sane again and decide to sensibly bring these things into balance, what would you recommend? I know you've written about this.
Yes, I put out a 30-year budget plan to stabilize the debt last June. Fully scored, fully specific, no gimmicks. This is what it takes. The first reality is everything has to be on the table. And that includes Social Security, Medicare, defense, taxing the rich, even taxing the middle class. The deficit's too big to do without everything. But the reality, too, is you're going to have to get most of the savings from Social Security and Medicare. And this is the part that makes people angry when I point this out. But the reality is nearly all of our long-term deficits are due to Social Security and Medicare shortfalls. Over the next 30 years, Social Security and Medicare are projected to run a cash shortfall of $124 trillion. The rest of the budget is roughly balanced over the next 30 years. And this is because, you know, Social Security and Medicare do not pay for themselves in payroll taxes and premiums. They're running a deficit of $500 billion this year. That's going to rise to $2.5 trillion a decade from now and even higher thereafter. You can't fix the budget with two programs running a deficit of $2.5 trillion in a decade and a deficit of 10% of the economy in three decades. So you're going to have to fix Social Security and Medicare, but you can't even get it all from there. We're not going to throw seniors out on the street. So you also have to look at Medicaid and defense and middle class taxes and taxing the rich, and everyone has to contribute. I put out a plan that hits everybody. And so there's something for everybody to hate, but this is what it takes.
Regarding Social Security, how much of a difference would it make in the viability of the program, the solvency, if we were to reduce the benefits that go to people who, say, when they retire, have more than $1 million in family wealth or something like that?
You could make a healthy difference. In fact,
okay,
the plan that I propose mostly is it's raising the eligibility age by 2 years. And then mostly reducing benefits for the richest people. There's a lot of rich people on Social Security. Seniors as a whole are substantially richer than the people paying the taxes into Social Security. And as a result, a lot of people are getting back a lot more than they paid in.
Can you pause on that for just a second, Jessica? That is, I mean, of all the planted misconceptions about Social Security, this is the champion. I'm getting back what I put in. And that, I mean, boy, that is just, that's not true, right?
No. In fact, even if you adjust for net present value, which is a fancy way of saying, let's adjust for inflation, let's adjust for interest rates, let's adjust for everything, the majority are still getting out about 20 or 30% more than they paid into Social Security, in some cases double what they paid in. And then if you go over to the Medicare side, it's even more amazing. The typical senior today is getting back triple the net present value of what they paid into Medicare. That's not the richest. That's the average senior is getting back triple what they paid in, even if you adjust for inflation and interest rates and everything else. You know, some seniors will say, I just want what I paid back in. And my response is, okay, deal. That would actually solve a lot of the problem.
Yes.
If they were only getting back what they paid in. I'm not sure they really want that.
Yeah. Okay. So to wrap up then, what do you expect in the coming 12 months and in the next 3 years? What do you think will happen to budget deficits, and what do you think will happen to the economy if you want to make so bold as to predict?
My prediction for the next 12 months is Congress does, in fact, pass $4.5 trillion of tax cuts. They do not pass any of the significant spending cuts. DOGE continues to identify what we consider to be budget dust, amounts
dust,
that aren't even a rounding error, but it's budget dust. So I think we're probably looking at deficits jumping right back up above $2 trillion, especially if interest rates keep rising. And, you know, at a certain point, that itself is going to start to notably weigh down the economy, which is already going to be struggling if the tariffs are enacted. If we do have the tariffs, I would not be surprised to see economic growth fall, possibly into the negative, possibly into a recession. There's a lot of factors that could push up inflation. The tariffs are inflationary. The deportations and immigration restrictions can be inflationary by creating worker shortages. Tax cuts and spending hikes are inflationary. And a president telling the Federal Reserve not to raise interest rates or I'll take over your controls could also be inflationary. So I think we're in a perilous spot right now with the economy over the next year, year and a half. I'm hoping cooler heads prevail in the White House. I'm not counting on it.
Yeah. Inflation is kind of the, it's the ultimate disciplinarian for irresponsible governments, right? Because all around the world, we have seen it over and over again, where you get demagogues in power and they promise their voters that they can have everything they want and they don't have to pay for it. And eventually it always results in raging inflation. And then the voters are much worse off than they would otherwise have been because of the, you know, inflation destroying their life savings and, you know, driving up the cost of everyday goods and, right?
Just look no further than the first year of the Biden presidency. We were already facing inflation that was probably going to head to 5 or 6% just from coming out of the pandemic, pent up demand, supply restrictions. We were probably going to go to 5 or 6% inflation. Biden shoots a $1.2 trillion bazooka into a supply constrained economy over the objections of even Democratic economists like Larry Summers and Jason Furman, who warned you add that much demand into a economy with supply constraints, you're going to have inflation.
Too much money chasing too few goods, as the old saying goes.
Instead of 5 or 6%, we went to 9%. And you could argue that cost the Democrats the White House.
Very much so. All right. Is there any any optimistic note that we can end on?
I think the tide is turning a little bit because, again, after the American Rescue Plan under Biden, you do see trillion-dollar spending plans not being circulated as much. Now, granted, we have big tax cuts to deal with, but at least you're not seeing the big trillion-dollar spending bills in the last couple of years. So hopefully that's a bit of progress. I'm trying.
Well, yeah, I know. Sorry, I did ask the toughest question was the last one.
even though this is a podcast, there should be an open bar because this stuff's pretty depressing.
It is, yes, very true. Well, we appreciate your coming on to elucidate these matters for our listeners, and we'll be in touch to see how things go over the next 12 months, see if your prediction was right.
I hope I'm wrong. I hope things are better than I predicted. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.